Mr. President, Ida, Eddie, it is a great privilege for me to have been given the assignment to introduce our next speaker. At this, the greatest demonstration of the support of American Jewry for Israel, and at a time when the demonstration of this sort is most critical in the affairs of the world, what you are doing here tonight, and what you are doing in Boston and New York and Chicago and Cleveland and Memphis and Minneapolis and Newark and New Brunswick and St. Louis and San Francisco and in many other places in this great country of ours, it proves to the world that not only are the Jews of Israel determined to continue to live, but that the Jews of America are determined that they shall continue to live. It is very difficult to find the words in a few short moments to describe my own feelings and the feelings of the Jews of the world concerning our speaker. All I can say is that at a time when we as a people had reached the very depths of despair, when 6 million of us had been wiped out, when we were reeling from the Holocaust of Hitler, there came a friend. And this friend was the most powerful man in the whole world. He was the President of the United States. As an humanitarian, he understood the need to provide a refuge for those of our brethren who are wasting away in the concentration camps. As an historian, he understood the justice of restoring to their ancient land the people of Israel. And as an American, he knew that it was good for America to promote a democracy in the sea of Middle Eastern feudalism. He was more than a friend. He was a tower of strength and encouragement to the people of Israel. Their trust in his integrity spurred them on to superhuman effort, and his trust in their integrity spurred him on to a continuous and unflinching and courageous program of help to this new sister republic. It is a great pleasure, a great privilege for me to present to this, the greatest audience ever assembled in the interest of Israel, the truest friend which Israel has ever had, the former President of the United States, Harry S. Truman.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
60s, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much. You know, you're just too kind to me. All of you are. I can't possibly be that good, but I like to hear it said anyway. I've come down here for a number of reasons. Two of them are Colonel Jacob Arvey and Abe Feinberg. I came here on Lincoln's birthday for Jake Arvey. You know, he's a colonel and an honorable, too. And I'll tell you a story about that right here. Scott Lucas was trying a case in Illinois. And they had an auctioneer on the stand who had a title of colonel. Colonel Arvey earned his colonel just the same as I did, by actual service. But the lawyer on the other side thought he'd discredit Scott Lucas's witness by showing that he had no title at all. So this fellow thought he'd be very smart, and he said, "No, Colonel, just exactly, this fellow who was questioning was a member of the Illinois legislature. Just what does that colonel in front of your name stand for?" "Well," he says, "it doesn't mean a thing in the world. It's just like that honorable in front of yours." Colonel Jake Arvey earned the colonel, and he earned the honorable, so he's not in that class at all. And Abe Feinberg has been my friend for, Abe, I don't know how long.
Longer than I care to admit,
he says. And he's a lot younger than I am. I'm very happy to be able to be with you tonight for this celebration. And I have some things I want to say to you. As I say, I was here the other day for Colonel Arvey. I'm here tonight for Abe Feinberg. And I'm going to be here on next Tuesday for myself. They say it's next Monday. I got the days crossed. It's the 25th, anyway. I don't know what the day of the week it is, but it's next Monday, so they tell me, for a library dinner for the welfare of my construction of a library to contain all my papers, all my presents, which I received as president, and a land value that's fantastic, which will be given to you as the government of the United States for your speech. Now, I'm happy to join with you this evening in honoring this great American comedian, Eddie Cantor. When he and George Jessel were on the vaudeville circuit, and I was a kid, I never missed an opportunity to go and see and hear them, and I learned all about both of them, particularly Eddie and his five daughters, and I only have one. I wish I had five. They tell me I'm going to be a grandpa. Well, you're celebrating the 65th birthday of this fellow, Eddie Cantor. He's just a child. I was 8 years old when he was born. So figure that one out if you can. For about four decades now, he's helped us to laugh. In bad times as well as good. And that's a real public service. And one for which we ought to be very thankful. And I'm sure we are, Eddie. And I hope you live another decade. Maybe two. I'm expecting to live to be 90, and I hope you do too. If you live to be 90, I'll be 98, so there we are. I made an announcement here not long ago that I was going to run for the presidency when I was 90 years old, and I was very carefully informed by some of these smart boys that look up the
year, because that was an off year and I couldn't run. Now, you don't honor Eddie tonight so much for his accomplishments as a comedian as for his warm heart and constant efforts in behalf of our youth and the unfortunate and oppressed of the earth. Eddie Cantor has always worked to bring happiness into the lives of others. It's only natural that one of his abiding interests should be the State of Israel, which was founded and exists today to provide a refuge and a new life for the most bitterly persecuted minority history has ever known. The future of Israel is an issue of great concern to many of us here tonight. Whatever our religious faith may be, it is an important matter to all Americans, and I want to talk about it particularly as it concerns the interests of all the citizens of this great republic. All Americans are horrified by the terrible crimes against the Jews committed by Hitler. All Americans today condemn the persecutions inflicted on the Jews behind the Iron Curtain. Behind the Iron Curtain, I hope you get that. Israel has given the survivors of these atrocities a new life. Israel today is welcoming Jewish refugees from all over the world. This is a work in which we as a nation have participated. It's a work which pulls at our heartstrings. For Israel, therefore, we have admiration and gratitude. Admiration for their will to exist in spite of all obstacles, and gratitude for giving us our moral code. If you haven't read the Torah at Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, I hope you'll do it, and then I hope you'll go a little further and go along with me and read the 5th, 6th, and 7th chapters of the Gospel according to St. Matthew, and you'll find that's where all our morals came from. And our great teacher was a Jewish rabbi. Don't forget that. We admire the great work that has been done in Israel to reclaim and build up the country and to create there a young and vigorous democracy. This is the work to which the State of Israel bonds are so important. And that work must go forward with redoubled energy because of the present troubled and uncertain state of affairs in the Middle East. As Americans, we look upon Israel not only as a great humanitarian enterprise and not only as a vigorous and modern democracy, but also as a part of the whole Middle East. I wish I had time to stand right here and discuss with you a settlement that could be made in that Middle East, but I can't. Not only as a government, but as a people, we have long shown our sympathy for all the peoples of the Middle East and our desire to help them. Before the Ottoman Empire fell, American missionaries and American educators had established colleges and universities in those countries, in Egypt, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Turkey. These institutions of learning helped to revitalize Arab culture. Many of the leaders in the movement toward Arab nationalities were educated by American teachers. When the Ottoman Empire broke up after World War I, President Wilson's 14 points opened the way to Arab leaders to create new and independent nations in the area. President Wilson even sent a fact-finding mission to the Middle East, which helped to lay the groundwork for the future independence of the Arab nations. Our friendly interest did not cease during the period between the two wars. After World War II, we used our influence to achieve complete independence for Syria and Lebanon. Through the United Nations, we supported the creation of the newest Arab state, that of Libya. And I want to say to you
that during the administration of which I was the head, there was a time when there was an opportunity to settle the whole arrangement over there so there would not have, this situation would not have been brought back about. And you know what happened? The Prime Minister of Lebanon, the Prime Minister of Iran, and the King of Transjordan were assassinated because they were in favor of that arrangement. Our interest in the creation of an independent state for the Jewish people in the Middle East was consistent with the policies which we had been following with respect to other peoples in that area. It was not an act of favoritism. The United States, by a resolution of the Congress as far back now as 1922, supported the establishment of a Jewish homeland. This resolution was consistent with the Balfour Declaration, the British Declaration by Balfour. 25 years later, we sponsored the recommendation of the United Nations Commission, which led to the establishment of the State of Israel. We hoped for a peaceful launching of the new state under the protection of the United Nations. We did not anticipate the outbreak of hostilities in Palestine, and we are proud of the great services rendered in bringing about an armistice by one of our most distinguished Americans, Dr. Ralph Bunche. It is important to recall all these facts at the present time. In the heat of the present controversies, it is easy to lose sight of a larger perspective of the whole, of which Israel is a part. It is easy to forget that our country has consistently encouraged the right of the peoples of the Middle East to national independence and self-government. It is easy to overlook the fact that we have helped and continue to help these countries with education and technical assistance. But these are the facts, and we have an interest in this area in the world, an interest in seeing these people achieve self-government and independence and economic and social progress. And we also have a responsibility. We have the responsibility of promoting peace among these new nations. We cannot expect new nations to be built without trouble and difficulty. Goodness knows we had plenty of trouble building our own nation. We ought to be sympathetic. We cannot expect them to find their places beside one another without friction and controversy. But since we took part in the creation of these nations, we must continue to take part in solving their difficulties. The possibility for the development of the Middle East hold out so much for the benefit of the people, of the people there, and for our whole democratic civilization, that we must do all we can to help. 1953, when it first became evident that our government had decided to follow a new policy, at least a new attitude toward Israel, I voiced a warning. I said that the condition of smoldering violence in the area would lead to graver dangers and disasters. I called on our government to do all within its power to get the Arab states and Israel to bargain together and reach a settlement. But I'm sorry to say, the policy on which our government had embarked did not bring about a situation that was conducive to reasonable agreement between Israel and the Arab states. On the contrary, it produced the opposite result, and conditions grew worse. Then in October 1955, when the news first broke that the Soviets were shipping arms to Egypt, I voiced another warning. I said that this was shocking news, that it threatened the future of the Middle East with a new danger, that we should be warned and on our guard. It was clear that the Soviet Union was planning to seize on the disturbed condition in the Middle East and exploit it to their advantage. If our government had recognized the dangers that lay in these arms shipments and had been willing to act boldly and firmly at the time, I believe that this whole disastrous scheme might have been nipped in the bud. but nothing was done. Soviet arms and agents flowed in, not only to Egypt, but also to Syria. And at the same time, we cut off all shipments of arms to Israel, which is the most cowardly thing we've done in many a day. There was a way to stop that situation. That was to keep Russia from coming out of the Black Sea Strait. From the time of Peter the Great, they've been trying to get a foothold in the Mediterranean Sea. The only time they succeeded in doing that was when we let their submarines come through there, when we could have said, you can't do it, you can't ship these arms. That's all we needed to do. You know the consequences. Today, as the result of drift and procrastination, it's not the future of Israel alone, nor the independence of the Arab states that is in danger. The threat no longer involves the Middle East only. It has spread to the future of Europe. The economic strength of the Western nations is being undermined. The diplomatic unity of the Atlantic allies has been jeopardized. The defense of our own country and of our way of life against the communist menace has been weakened. The present situation is dark and full of peril. And you know I'm an optimist, and I don't like to make a statement like that, but it's true. Although the Eisenhower Mideast plan at long last is a beginning, it is too little and too late. Its chances of solving the problem by itself are very limited. It is clearly an emergency reaction to a danger that has grown from small beginnings and spread without effective countermeasures on our part until that danger is now the most threatening of the most threatening proportions. No matter how firmly we may assert our determination to resist open communist aggression in the area, no matter how loudly we may challenge the Soviets, we can be sure of one thing. The communists will keep up their subversive intrigue and their armed shipments so long as there is tension in the Middle East and so long as relations between Israel and the Arab states are based on suspicion and violence. We won't get anywhere with this Middle East situation unless we go to the root of the trouble. The present strategy of the administration seems to be to leave all these key matters to the United Nations to work out. But the United Nations is only as strong as its members and only as wise as the policies which its members urge it to adopt. We are one of its members and should be the leader of the free world. We cannot hide behind the skirts of the United Nations or duck the responsibility of having some policy of our own. Repeat that. We cannot hide behind the skirts of the United Nations or duck the responsibility of having some policy of our own for the settlement of the conflicts in the Middle East. Furthermore, the solutions or settlements proposed by the United Nations must be fair to all states. Nations like householders are entitled to protection against bandits and thugs. If they do not get such protection from the United Nations, they will have to do what they can to provide it for themselves. No government can survive if it allows its citizens to be murdered by wandering gangs of commandos or permits its parks to be illegally blockaded. And unless the United Nations can protect Israel from such wrong, it is not morally justified in asking Israel to give up the means of protecting itself. An unfair settlement that does not, in fact, establish justice will not be effective. But if it is accepted temporarily, the same old trouble will blaze out again, and things then will be worse than before. The time is long overdue for our government to adopt a clear and vigorous policy in the Middle East, to use its influence and power to bring peace, to make known where it stands, and above all, to work together with its friends and allies. In spite of the dangers of the present, Israel will survive as it did of old. Now I'm looking forward to the time when Zion will again be a place of peace. The survival of Israel has always been a matter of faith, of the faith that moves mountains. From the days of the Hebrew prophets to our own, Israel has been faithful to its belief and to its covenant with God. The creation of the State of Israel has been a miracle of modern times. We, in this fortunate and prosperous country, the United States, can never be indifferent to its fate. And we as citizens must do all in our power to correct the mistakes and blundering of our own government. We must hold our elected leaders by the force of public opinion to the only course of conduct that can preserve peace in the Middle East and save Israel from destruction. This will avert a major disaster in the Middle East, which could easily bring on World War III. Let us put forth every effort possible to preserve the peace in the Middle East and pray that World War III will never come. Truman, on behalf of the close to 3,000 people here and the tens of thousands of people that are seeing this program by television and the millions of American Jews who are not tuned into it, may I on their behalf genuinely and honestly express our sincere love and affection for you, sir. Thank you very much. Just a word. You know, I'm almost 73 years old, and I work every day as hard as I possibly can, and I hope you will forgive me if I now go home and go to bed. I think I've helped you all I can.